Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Jordan Salcido, founder of Ramona and Bellis Wines and director of wine special projects at Momofuku. We'll talk to Jordan about wine spritzers, wine, women in wine, social media, Momofuku, and a bunch of other stuff. We'll also taste the Bellis Rosé and some Ramona for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Jordan Salcido is the founder of Bellis Wines and Ramona Artisanal Wine Coolers. She's the director of wine special projects at Momofuku and is a Master Sommelier candidate. Jordan is a Wine and Spirits Best New Sommelier and one of Wine Enthusiast's Top 40 Under 40 Tastemakers. She's worked in some of the finest restaurants in New York, including Danielle, Veritas, 11 Madison Park, and The Crown. And now she makes wine, too. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Jordan.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's an honor to be here.
I've been looking forward to having you on. I think it's a great way. This is our last show for our spring-summer season. And I think we have the right person and the right juice to slot in for that.
I am very happy and very touched that okay. I get to be here for this.
So I want you to just give our audience a little context about who you are, because you've had a pretty colorful life in wine, and you are still very young. So tell us about your journey in life and wine that got you to the present, which is really juggling three things: Momofuku, Bellis, which is a wine company, and Ramona, which, you know, we'll get into, is a canned spritzer. So buzz through it quickly.
Okay,
all right. Because there's other stuff I want to talk to you about.
Okay, we'll do the express train through the old wine past. Very quickly started in writing, so that's what
I thought. Well, first, grew up in Denver, Colorado.
Grew up in Denver, Colorado. Moved to Philadelphia, went to college, lived in Italy.
Haverford College,
okay. Exactly. You are good.
Philosophy major,
English. But that's philosophy. Okay. Yeah, totally. Right. Although, as my dad said, it teaches you how to think.
Right.
He said, as long as you come away,
you think, therefore you are.
Yeah, or okay. You think, therefore you can get out of whatever bad experience you create for yourself.
So college brought you east.
College brought me east, and then college brought me to Italy. And then after...
Why? A semester abroad?
Semester abroad, okay. Yep. Studied in Florence and loved it and loved... Loved it, and also, that's another story. But yes, that was also the first time that I started drinking wine that was not Franzia or wine coolers.
Good place to start.
Totally, or Natty Light or, you know, something like that. So So moved back, and I knew I wanted to live in New York. So I moved to New York right after that and worked at a couple of places, one of which got me into, I was organizing these wine tastings, which I always thought was really interesting. But the final job that I had before moving actually back to Colorado, the job that made me realize I loved restaurants was working as a hostess at WD-50 right when it opened.
Very cool place, Wiley.
Wiley's amazing.
Yeah. And he has a donut shop now.
He has, and there's such good donuts. Oh, my
Dew's
goodness.
Dew's
Donuts, yeah. And coffee. It's so good. And he's just really thoughtful and cerebral. And so I thought, okay, I don't know what I'm doing enough to commit to anything, but I do know I love this world. And seeing him as an example of like somebody who chose restaurants and was doing it well and doing it thoughtfully and like crushing it in this way that I never knew, could be done in restaurants. Moved back to Colorado. Started writing for the Denver Post. I sent, you know, some sample writing and
food, wine, or general.
Food, yeah,
you were focusing on
cheap eats columnist. Okay. Yeah, so I did that. I was working, you know, some odd jobs, and then I also went to culinary school. Got a scholarship to culinary school.
Johnson and Wales.
Johnson and Wales, exactly.
Was there one out in Colorado?
Yeah, there was in Colorado. So
was that a good experience?
It was. It was great because at that point it was before there were blogs, which I know sounds crazy that like I'm basically a dinosaur. So it was before blogs were as relevant as the traditional press. And I used to read the New York Times every week and I would like wait for Tuesday afternoon when like the Wednesday review would come out. And I remember Amanda Hesser was writing at the time and I loved her writing style and I just felt like that's what I wanted to do. And so I went to culinary school because I felt like the thing that I could offer, especially in a place like Denver where, you know, there were people with opinions, but nobody writing about food actually had ever worked in it. And so that was sort of the direction that I was going.
That perspective.
Yeah. And you had to take wine classes in culinary school. You had to take like a beginning one. And then
so that's a year program, a little less?
Exactly. It was a year program called Garnish Your Degree because I think it's longer if you didn't have a degree. But because I had already graduated from Haverford and I had my undergrad, then it was just 1 year. And as I finished that, you had to, in order to graduate, you had to go and cook in a restaurant.
Isn't there a name for that?
Yes. It's called an externship, which is not intuitive. Everyone says, what's
an
externship?
And it's not stage?
It's like a stage, but it's like a stage could be 4 hours, whereas an externship is like
a longer commitment.
A longer commitment, exactly.
So you did that where?
I did that at Danielle, and that's how I ended up at
Jesus, right out of the chute, right?
Well, I think by that point, I knew I wanted to get back to New York, and I knew that I wanted to do it well, and that I wanted to have a firmer footing and a firmer foundation than I did when I was living in New York the first time as a hostess at WD-50, where I knew what I liked, but had no idea how to get there. And it just, sometimes I feel like I don't know like the next five steps, but I can tell that the next step.
Well, there's obviously steps because so far you're talking about culinary school and cooking. And as we get to where you are now, I mean, there's a turn. So when does it turn and why?
It turned as soon as my culinary, I guess it was like the very end of my externship. The last thing that I got to do at my externship was cook at the La Pole de Neige with Danielle.
Which is in the La Pole of Colorado.
Exactly. Right. You are so on top of all this stuff.
A little smaller, though, which was good for you. Because the one in New York, you probably would have had a heart attack.
Totally. Yeah. So it was like Danielle, the chef, Olivier, who was at DB Bistro at the time, Ryan Hardy, who was the chef at the Nell. Now he's my husband's business partner at Pasquale Jones and Charlie Bird. And a couple other people, but Danielle said, and I guess the other thing was like in my free time, and the days were long when you're working in the kitchen at Danielle, but I would always come home and I would read, Clive Coates's Côte d'Or. I just wanted to read as much as I could about Burgundy. And a couple of times Danielle would be, you know, he'd come home from the lounge and he'd come into the kitchen from the lounge after service had ended and there would be, you know, some incredible half bottle of wine left and he would always share it. And
nice.
So nice. And so,
were you drinking stuff that he brought out for the first time, or you had been exposed to some of it?
Yeah, some of it I had been exposed to, and some of it it was the first time.
Right.
And I had just started, or was just about to start dating the man who is now my husband, Robert Bohr.
Now, was Robert at Danielle then?
He was not, no, but he was at Crew.
Which was after Veritas.
Which was, well, they were competitors. So
They were.
So after Danielle, I ended up working at Veritas, but
right.
he was at Crew during this
right.
time, and the wines that they would have open regularly
crazy.
Were crazy.
Crazy collection.
Crazy. And now looking back, I mean, those wines are insane, and you can't track them down, and
no.
if you can, they're 20 grand a bottle. But right. at the time, it was like, oh, this is a really beautiful
well,
wine.
Let's tell people what La Paulée is. La Paulée is like a Burgundy festival for a group of people that pay to get in.
Yep.
And it's an exposure to some of the greatest wines, which is one of the last opportunities to taste what we just talked about.
Totally.
So you were cooking, you know, for that crap.
Yes.
All right. So we got to move quicker.
Yep. Oh, yeah. All right.
So Danielle.
Danielle said you.
Exposed you to wine.
He did. And he said you love.
Or tasted with you.
Yeah. No, he just said you love this. You know everything about this. You clearly like care about this in your time off. You should work Harvest. And,
was that an influence, a thought, you know,
it
provoker?
It was a dream, but not one that I would have ever entertained.
But he had credibility when he suggested that, like, maybe this guy's onto something.
Yeah, or like, wow, how does that even happen?
Okay.
And so anyway, through that trip, I lined up Harvest in Burgundy, and that was 2006. So that was the first time I worked Harvest. And anyway, switched over to the front of the house at Danielle. I was offered a job in the kitchen and could tell at that point that my interest was wine. But I just didn't know what part of the wine world made sense.
Right.
But I knew that I wanted to sort of throw myself in as much as possible. So, Danielle, busboy, you know, lounge server, et cetera.
Did everything.
A lot. And then worked Harvest, and that was game changing for me. And
when you talk about Harvest, I mean, total to date, how many harvests have you done?
Oh, my goodness. Every harvest I've done at, you know, some harvests have been longer than others, but every year since 2000
and Patagonia.
Italy, a lot of France. Yep.
Burgundy.
So it was Burgundy 2006 through 2012, with the exception of 2011, which is when we were opening Crown. So I didn't.
So you would fit in the harvest between
always.
And
yeah.
Tell me about the remaining things you did.
Yeah. So I guess that harvest just helped inform my opinions about wines on the floor, or it added an extra layer when I was talking to guests who were curious about the region or this vineyard versus that vineyard, that kind of thing. So that was just something that got built in. After Danielle, I worked at Veritas, and then my first sommelier job was at Nick and Tony's out in East Hampton. And then that led to working at 11 Madison Park. There was a regular customer at Nick and Tony's who said, you have to work for USHG. And then I had an interview there right after working Harvest in 2007 in Burgundy. And that led to EMP, which was like wine graduate school. It was like wine service graduate school.
How many years were you there?
I was there, let's see, over the course of four different years, but not four consecutive
right.
years. So I was there.
What was the longest stretch? A couple of years?
A year-ish.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I guess just over a year probably.
So you did that.
I did that.
But you did other things.
I did other things, yeah. So that's when I had the idea of starting Bellis. And Bellis had been in my head for a while, or something like Bellis, because I just felt like the wines that I got to drink and open and serve and pour every night were amazing, and people who were these brilliant friends that worked in other industries would be like, oh, this Ravenau you opened, can I find that pretty easily? And I'd be like, actually, no.
All right, so we're going to come to Bellis a little later.
Yeah. Oh,
you know,
okay.
I want to get into the story
oh, got it.
There.
Okay.
So let's just finish the Jordan Salcedo life chronology.
Okay.
So you worked... The Crown, was that a Graydon Carter thing? Or
no.
John DeLucci.
John DeLucci,
who
exactly.
was Graydon's original
yeah,
chef.
Yeah, exactly.
You did that.
Did that.
When did you get to Momofuku and anything in between I missed?
Let's see. There was guilt for like a split little
Patrick
second.
Patrick Capiello?
With Patrick, yeah.
Fun guy.
He's such a fun guy. He's
yep.
amazing. Yeah,
yeah.
So I got to work
he's
with Patrick.
He's been on the show. He's terrific.
He's so great.
He just opened a place in Philly, so he's...
No way.
Yeah. Walnut Street Cafe.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Good for him.
So then you get to Momofuku. How?
All right. So I had just finished working at Crown, and I had just decided, you know what, I'm going to stop working in restaurants for a little while. I guess throughout this course of this whole time,
What year can you peg me?
This was fall of 2012.
So the Bellis thing was happening before, which I said we'll get to,
or
the thought of it.
Yeah.
All right. So tell me Momofuku.
So Momofuku was right after Crown, and I decided I was not going to work in restaurants anymore. I was going to focus on just my MS for a little while and focus on Bellis. And Wells Guthrie of Copan had asked for Robert and I to come out and help him pour wines at this dinner because David Chang was coming, and he was very excited, but he was surprised that Dave himself was going to be there, and would we
very
help
cool.
choose and pour wine. So of course we said yes. I had been spending some time in California in the vineyards anyway, just checking up on a couple things. And anyway, within like 5 minutes of getting there, Dave was just hanging out and we started talking, and he was like, well, what are you doing these days? And I was like, oh, I'm actually, you know, I'm taking some time off of restaurants. I'm really just going to focus on Bellis.
He talked you into it?
Yeah, he did. He said, well, you know, I think I might need someone for the programs. And, you know, we really want to focus on Moff Pesh at first because, you know, there's this like physical space that we can, where we can
right.
have a great cellar. And, you know, I see more and more that wine is important and that wine matters. And by the way, I think it's delicious. And so we started chatting. And
how long did it take you to decide?
I mean, that was in California. So within the next week or two, I think that was like November or December. I think that was December. Within the next couple weeks, I went to meet with Dave and then his business partner at the time, Drew, and a couple of key people from the team. And then that led to a couple other meetings. And then I guess for me, I just felt like it was important to be able to keep Bellis and not have to give that up because I...
So you made that part of the understanding.
Yeah, and I just said I think it's valuable. You know, I'll be out there doing harvest, and what I've seen in the past is that only makes me a better teacher when it
right.
comes to training the team and talking to
guests. And that was about 4.5 years ago, right?
That's crazy.
Right? Crazy.
That's so crazy.
All right, so that brings you to current.
That brings us
Momofuku,
to current.
Yeah. And, you know, you have Bellis, and we'll talk about Ramona. But I want to ask you a bunch of other things before we get into that. I'm curious about why sommeliers want to make wine.
Interesting, yeah.
I mean, do you equate that to chefs wanting to own a restaurant? Because there's a good handful of good people that are making, you know, Raj, Parr,
totally.
Dust.
Yeah.
Why do Psalms make wine? I mean, is that the dream? What was your thinking?
Well, I know plenty of Psalms who are like, I would never want to make wine. I think it's
okay.
the stupidest thing ever. And for me, my grandfather used to make wine in his basement in Waterbury, Connecticut.
Italian?
Yeah, yeah.
The old Italian crappy basement wine?
Oh, totally. And I never knew him. He died when my dad was 13, so I never met him. But that was part of the family narrative. So I don't know whether it's genetic or I actually didn't even know that until I had ended
up in
work.
Did your dad get a kick out of it? Like he'd light up when he talked about it or he talks?
He did, yeah.
So it was a cool thing in his youth or whatever.
I think so. And it was, let's see. I guess for me, I didn't know what I was missing until I went over and worked that first harvest. So working harvest, and I guess coming from the chef background, like there's something very, very, I think, educational about being able to create or make something, because then you learn by doing. You learn by either doing something well or doing something poorly, like writing a wine program or making a by the glass list or whatever it is. But there's an act of creation, even if you're just helping somebody else. So I just felt like there was only upside to working harvest. A, as like a Colorado girl, that got me out of the city
right.
for a few weeks. And B, I then came back with like these stories that you can't read in a book anywhere, and these techniques that you don't get to read in a book, they don't make sense in the same way that they do when you're watching the decisions be made in real time, and just seeing sort of who pays attention to what details, and then what does that result in the finished wine. So I think that was always fascinating to me, and I don't want to jump ahead to Bellis, but I guess the idea of Bellis, where it started, has shifted a little bit. But where it started was wanting to be able to make a wine that offered the same value system. And I guess this part has not changed. Offer the same value system and level of integrity as some of these great wines of the world, but at a friendlier price point, using maybe land that's not as famous or you know, there are a number of factors.
Great winemakers.
Yeah.
Great areas.
Totally.
And not expensive stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Very cool. So I guess your sensibilities, the things you were doing, you probably worked as many or more harvests than anyone, not in the winery business, all that influenced you to, it wasn't just a vanity thing. It was
the next
logical thing for you to.
Yeah. And I would say it was intended to be the opposite of a vanity thing. So in addition to, you know, making the wine, we also, we donate a percentage of proceeds to different organizations.
Well, we'll get to that brand by brand and all that. Okay. I don't, you know, because there's a lot to talk about.
Okay.
So now we know why you make wine. I would bet you that if you brought in five sommeliers, they have five different stories.
Totally.
You know, so that's cool. All right. The other thing, and I always wrestle whether to ask this question or not, because at this point, it's, I don't know how much of a subject it is, but you're more than just a woman sommelier now. I mean, you started, we have your history, and you became a sommelier. Now you're not a woman in the wine business. You're a woman in the business of wine. And I always wonder, in 2017, are women still perceived and treated equally in the wine world, either on the floor or in business? I mean, do you... How much are you willing to talk about that?
It's a great question. I think, I mean, the only experience I can speak to is my own, and I feel like I have been very fortunate when it comes to, and I think, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, you know, you're going to hit challenges in life, and it's a matter of sort of like looking in the mirror and saying, how did I impact that outcome that is not the outcome that I wanted? And how can I shift my mindset or behavior so that the outcome is different next time? And I think self-awareness is important. I would love to say I'm the most self-aware person. I'm sure that there are many examples where
but
I'm
it's
not,
important but to you to be aware.
Yeah,
and self-awareness is important.
Is.
I totally get that.
And I think, you know, working hard, we always, you know, everyone in New York works hard, but I think that was something that it was a value system that was important to my parents when we were growing up, and my grandmother, who's my dad's mother, she was a mother of five, and then her husband passed away when her young twins were 13. So, I mean, they were 13 by that point. They weren't babies, but she walked into the Timex factory, or maybe it wasn't Timex. She walked into whatever factory it was.
Watches?
It was a watch factory in Waterbury, Connecticut, and she said, my husband died. I have five kids. They all have to go to college. I need a man's job with man's wages. And she started working two jobs over time by herself so that she still cooked dinner for everyone on Sundays. And she's for sure a personal hero, and I just think of that, and it's like, okay, no matter what's hard or whatever, you know, whatever difficulty I'm looking at, there's nothing that will ever be as hard or that I've ever encountered.
So that's your approach. So the good news is there's no real gripes or negatives. You know, New York's a good place for women and wine.
New York is a good place for diversity.
Union Square Hospitality Group, half their somms, you know, are women, which is a great, you know, town and all of that. And I'm glad to hear that. But it does go back to what you said, which is how you as a person handle it and approach it, and hard work and, you know, all of that stuff's very important. So there's a good chance I may never ask that question again. All right. The other thing that I wanted to ask you, and this is, I think, something that's been important to you, is I want to get your take on how social media has had an impact on you, your career, and your career has been you as a brand, but also developing real brands like Bellis and Ramona. And Ramona's a very striking packaging, you know, in-your-face type brand, and it's a perfect social media type product. So tell me the impacts and how you use it.
Yeah.
And do you think it would be the same without it?
It's so interesting. I think we are definitely in a moment now where social media is a tool that can be very helpful. I remember the first, it was actually when I was starting Bellis, and somebody told me I should read Gary Vaynerchuk's book.
Gary's a dear friend.
He's amazing.
Did you read Crush It or another one?
I read Crush It. Crush It had just come out.
That was the map for setting up social media.
Yes, and I forget who told me to read it. It was somebody who, you know, randomly suggested it, and I bought it right away. But it made an impression, and he was very smart in laying out his argument, and I just figured, okay, why not? And at the time, Instagram didn't exist, and I think it was like Facebook and Twitter.
Right. You realize how much in the infancy these things
are. Yeah, it's so crazy.
So that got you inspired.
That did. And then I would say, like, I began to really take Instagram seriously right after starting to work at Momofuku. Because it's
for the wine program and the restaurant and you and the business and all that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Dave does it really well. And so I was just sort of around it in a way where I hadn't been before. And I just saw how it could be very powerful in spreading awareness about different things. And so, I mean, to your point, Ramona is something. Watching Ramona on Instagram has been very important for us in a way that I never would have expected.
You put Instagram at the top of the list more than Twitter. It's not a Snapchat thing.
Yeah.
Because you could do video and you could do the still pictures.
Exactly. And I think Snapchat is amazing. But to be honest, once Instagram came out with Instagram Story, then it just...
You're not the only person who thinks that. Do you think, and I guess you could say Ramon is a bit of a sensation. Do you think it would be the sensation it is? I mean, I know that because you told me you sold out. Do you think it would be the sensation it is without social media?
That's a very good question. But we definitely have entire states asking for it because they've seen it on social media.
Right. People use it for discovery.
They do.
Like, this is cool. This looks cool.
Totally. And it looks different than other things that are out there. And
so the answer is probably not. Probably its exposure and popularity is due to social media, and the audience matches.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think our audience spends a lot of time there. I think, you know, we have stories that, you know, people who I would never call our, you know, Ramona target market, but they like it anyway, or like, you know, sometimes it's like people's great aunts are like really fans of Ramona.
Right.
They don't know what Instagram is.
Are you have these two wine companies, you have the Momo. Are you disciplined with your social media, or do you wake up and go, oh, I forgot to post pictures from last night? I mean, do you approach it seriously? I mean, be honest.
I mean, I definitely would say more than any, like with Ramona, yes. So with Ramona, we have a schedule and we sort of try to think about like, oh, it's national Lazy Days coming up. So we have a post for that.
You try to relate to all of that stuff.
Yeah, there was like National Sunglasses Day. So that matters for Ramona's Instagram. But for my own personal, it's just sort of like, do I feel like posting this or not? There's no algorithm to it.
Right. And we'll give you all the social media handles, you know, towards the end of the show. Let me get personal for a second. It's no secret that you're married to Robert Bohr. You talked about it. You know, truly one of the most prolific wine guys around. Yeah. And now, you know, a very prolific restaurateur. I'm just curious. You know, you probably went through the period of courting each other and falling in love and blah, blah, blah. But at some point you settle down, you move on, you have a kid and all that. When you look back about what influence he's had on you in the wine silo, I mean, did he change the way you look at wine, taste it? Did he shift you from crappy wines? What was the influence?
Oh, good question. I mean, his influence was massive for sure. I would say.
But specifically,
okay. So specifically, when we were just starting to date, that's when he had crew and the wine world was at the peak. And so he would open bottles of, I remember it was like, you know, one of our early dates. And he opened a bottle of Henri Jaillet Brulé that was, you know, 20 plus years old at the time. And it was extraordinary. And it was this incredible opportunity to taste wines that are very hard to get a hold of. And they were hard to get a hold of back then, too, but there was no...
So he exposed
he
you
did.
To and, that.
And so I would say that...
Would talk about the magic and the glass type stuff?
Yeah, and I would say, like, because of those conversations, I had smarter questions when I was working in Harvest in Burgundy or when conversations with friends would come up. Or so those, that exposure made me...
He's a heady guy,
right? He's a very heady guy, yeah. And he cares, and I never wanted to be the dumb person in the room, and so...
So he elevated you
yeah,
to or, his level. That's a say, good influence.
It was a great influence. Or he would say, like, well, these are interesting books to read. Like, these, of the 10 books on Burgundy you could read, these are the four that, you know, I would read first. And,
right.
like, this is the one that you should start with because it matters the most. And I would say, in addition to that, that also, yeah, so I like the education that I received through just exposure
right.
was incredible. But also I think it was important to me that I not be defined in the same way because we were two different people
right.
with two different points of view.
Right. As it should be.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into Bellis Ramona, I'm just curious. You're a mom now. Do you drink less now because you have a kid?
Oh, that's a good question.
I mean, do you, like, you just don't whip one open and drink it because, you know, you got to put the kid to bed?
Such a good question.
Has that influenced and changed how much wine you drink?
Not how much wine I taste, but how much wine
not I tasting because you could drink.
Yeah, probably so. If I'm being honest, probably so. Yeah, I'm sure that it does. However, now that he goes to bed, what we do is we'll like if I go out, it'll be at 8:30.
You
so
have
it's
time
like,
to
yeah, put him.
So
down.
You it probably affected you at the beginning, and now you're back into a routine.
Yeah,
and all
for
of
sure,
it.
For sure.
All right, we're talking to Jordan Salcido. Jordan is the founder of Bellis and Ramona, and she is the wine person over at Momofuku. All right, so let's talk quickly about Momofuku. You're there now. That was your wine job. Your tenure there is longer than anywhere else.
For sure, yeah.
Why? I mean, what's...
Dave, I have to say, Dave is incredibly gifted in so many ways. And one thing that he's done so brilliantly, or that at least that resonates very strongly with me, is he gives the people that he hires, he empowers them to do what he initially hires them to do. And so
that's how you build you.
Yeah.
The employee before the customer.
Yeah.
If you're happy, you'll make the customer
I think
happy.
So.
That's a Danny Meyer thing.
Yeah,
too.
And I would say, like, it's definitely phrased different. I think he thinks of it as,
yeah,
like,
I'm not saying
yeah,
that's
yeah,
his,
yeah.
But there's a umbrella that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, if I hire someone who knows what they're doing and I give them the tools to build something
great. That's a
great,
good manager.
Yeah, then they'll do it.
All right, so he's about food-wise as unconventional as he can get. If you look at each restaurant, I mean, in the offerings, I mean, it's crazy, even his original stuff. You know, you've been responsible for selecting wines and pairing and all of that. I mean, was it a challenge? And also, I know that the Momofuku, is it Momofuku Co., the wine list is sort of set up in a different way. So talk about the fact that you're subjected to this crazy food and you got to match wines.
Yes.
Was it French-centric, Italian? I mean, what's the obvious things that match with that type of food?
So such a good question. I would say more stylistic than a particular country.
Okay.
But a lot of times, and I think the misconception is that wine is hard to pair with Dave's food, when in fact it's not at all, as long as you have food or wine with acidity, which almost...
So acidity is a key there than other places.
I think
where
so.
The food's a little more finessed or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and it's like light on its feet and delicate and nuanced. And so I think you want something that's sort of, that's able to dance around that and really highlight those flavors.
So if I said, okay, I'm David Chang, this is my type of food, I think, you know, I know we need wines, you know, that have good acidity. What are the 2-3 regions or wines that come to mind? Is it Riesling? I mean, what's your answer?
Like the
don't agree with me.
Yeah.
What's your answer?
Okay. Well, I think Champagne.
Okay. Always great.
Yep. In fact, we did an all.
So a lot of Champagne offerings.
Yeah, we did at Co. back when it was in the old space. We did an all sparkling pairing menu.
I like that. What else?
Let's see. Burgundy.
Burgundy.
Both white and red.
Okay.
Is always always a good choice.
And what's the outlier on this? What's the one that would surprise me?
Oh, I mean, things like maybe like the Savoie or like
okay.
Alto. Let's see.
Alto Adige, were you going to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cooler climate whites, or even things like Chenin Blanc, if you're just going to make taking, you know.
Good white for that.
Yeah.
Good choices. All right. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about Bellis. I want to talk to you about Ramona. I want to subject you to our wine list, which is a handful of questions. I'm curious on your take. And then I think when we come back, you know, we're also going to end the show with our weekly wine sip. But I think we should get some stuff cracking by now anyway.
Love it.
So we're here with Jordan Salcido. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be back right after these words.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market believes in seeking out local, fresh, and seasonal food, and in supporting local farmers, makers, and the community as a whole, economically and agriculturally. Whole Foods Market believes in food that is vivid and colorful, fresh and full of nutrients, food that connects you to your body, the seasons, and to nature, food that helps you do more, sleep better, and wake up happier. Found in over 400 locations throughout the United States, Whole Foods Market only sells food that meets their standards, which means no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, ever. Whole Foods Market believes in real food. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more.
All right, we're back. We are back with my guest, Jordan Salcido, founder of Bellis and Ramona Wines, the wine person over at Momofuku David Chang's restaurant. And I want to talk to Jordan. I want to talk to you about your two wine projects. Let's talk about Bellis first. You mentioned earlier it was an idea that was about 2011. Just quickly, because I wouldn't let you get into it. Why did you start Bellis?
Yes. Okay. So I wrote down the idea on a plane back from actually the, I think it was the Palais in spring of, you know, 2010 probably. But the idea was, why isn't there, or what if there could be a sort of wine that adhered to the same value system as these great wines of the world that we got to open every night in the restaurant floor?
And that sommelier sensibility, being exposed to so many wines at so many price points, you realize there was a void?
Yes.
Okay.
And I would say now that void is a much smaller void because I think the wine market caught up. But, you know, this was starting back in 07, 08, and then it was like 09, 010 when this really, when this idea started to crystallize. But it also felt like I got to work in these incredible restaurants and I had access to, you know, so much luxury in the, you know, on the floor every night. And that's not real life. That's everyone's escape. But yet that was my real life.
Some people eat out 2-3 nights a week at those places, but the rest of us want a good bottle of wine at home or...
Exactly. And so and the other thing, I guess I was just coming, getting familiar with the blind tasting. And so I felt like the thing that was very powerful for me was once I understood how to describe what I liked in a wine or what I didn't like in a wine, then that could lead me very quickly to...
Transfer that to what you want to put on the table.
Yeah, because so many friends would say, why? You know, hey, I really like that Raveno. Can I have a bottle? Or, oh, how hard is it to find 85 Boujac Bon Mar? It's very hard. And by the way, it's not in your everyday budget. So.
Right. So Bellis has, what, 5-6 different offerings?
Five different wines.
Yep. And tell me, I know them, but tell our listeners what countries you... go to bottle these wines. And
yes.
I think that has something to do, maybe except for California, with keeping the price down.
Yeah, for sure.
So you make wines from...
California, as you mentioned, and Italy.
You make a couple of rosés.
Yes, we make two rosés with Michael Cruz, although going forward, we're only going to make one with Michael Cruz.
Okay. You're lucky to get Michael.
I know.
He's
so
a rock
amazing.
Star, yeah.
He's amazing, yeah.
So you're looking for the other wine to work with someone else?
No, we don't want to make a still rosé.
Okay.
Yeah, at least not in California, I think.
So Michael's going to make the sparkling rosé
exactly.
with you.
Exactly.
So what is it, ultramarine and his pet Ness.
He has those.
Yeah. You got the right guy.
But we felt like we wanted to do a sparkling domestic bougie Sardon because there's nothing domestic.
So bougie, B-U-G-E-Y?
Exactly.
Sardon, C-E-R-D-O-N. What is that?
Yeah, so it's a sparkling rosé. It's a small appellation in France, in the Savoie, so foothills of the Alps, limestone soil. And the grapes are, in the area, it's Gamay with a little bit of Poulsard.
Nice.
And this idea, actually, I made the first one with Wells Guthrie. He had Poulsard vines, and he wanted to collaborate. And so we're like, okay, we don't...
Wells Guthrie had Poulsard in California?
He actually, they're suitcase clones from Jacques Pouffenet.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
And so he was like, we should do a still Pinot Noir together. And I don't feel like I have much to add to that conversation. And so we started talking a little bit more. And it's like, why hasn't anyone tried
it? So that's California. Mm-hmm. You have a still and a sparkling. You're going to go to sparkling.
Yep.
Then you have a few wines from Italy.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me what they are.
Okay, so we have the white Caldera. It's Falanghina from
Caldera.
Yep.
Caldera
yep.
is white. The grape is Falanghina. Okay.
Yep. That one's named after Mount Vesuvius, which is this, very powerful, violent volcano that...
So the soils are volcanic or whatever?
Yes. Okay. The volcanic tuff soil and some limestone, and it's pretty diverse up there. And it's pretty high elevation. And we have a great winery partner over there. And the idea...
You sought out winemakers and partners.
Yes.
You tasted and you knew people, tried to get people on board.
Exactly.
That's how you partnered with
exactly.
these guys. Okay.
And it was always important to me to make sure the grapes were grown organically or without, chemical pesticides and herbicides.
So guys have been growing grapes without pesticides, herbicide, whatever, for years, but don't necessarily register or label themselves.
Exactly.
But they, all right. So that is Caldera from Campania?
From Campania.
Okay. Yeah. And then a couple more things from Italy?
Yeah. And then the Frappato. So Frappato from Sicily.
Frappato is the grape.
Frappato is the grape. Yep.
White or red?
It's red.
I knew that.
Yeah.
Just from my audience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. So Frappato I call it like Sicilian Pinot Noir.
Okay. It's got that little lighter body.
Yes. Okay. And very fragrant and perfumed. Pinot Noir is thin-skinned, and in years where there's maybe a little bit of bunch rot or anything like that, Frappato is the grape that is the most affected, and historically it was only reserved for the royalty or the nobility, and then the dregs were sort of left behind for everyone else to get to blend with Nero d'Avola, which is a much hardier...
Deep, dark, brooding.
Yeah.
What? Okay, so that's from Sicily, and then... You can't go to Italy and not make a Tuscan wine.
Totally.
So you make what?
Yes. So that's where it all started, was in Tuscany.
Okay.
So we make a Sangiovese. It's mostly Sangiovese with Chilijolo, Canaiolo, and Colorino. In the village, the vineyards are in a village called Montaione.
Right, which is near what, Montalcino?
It's like if you take Ponzano, or it's sort of like a midpoint, but farther west.
Okay.
Between Florence and Ponzano.
Okay.
Our partner there is a guy named Michael Schmelzer, and he is amazing.
Nice Italian boy.
Yeah.
Michael Schmelzer.
His family's German. His wife is American, but speaks fluent Italian, and they live with their two daughters in Ponzano, and they, just amazing people.
So going forward, you're going to continue to make the Sicilian Scopello, the Campanian Caldera. You're going to do the one sparkling wine, the Tuscany Girasole. add or delete anything, or kind of go with that for now?
I think go with that for now. Okay. We'll see. We'll see. All Maybe right. we do a still wine from Puglia or something like that.
We'll keep
like
everyone
this,
posted. Yeah. And there is, I don't want to leave Bellis without talking about the fact that you've put a charitable aspect to the brand. Just tell me quickly what that is.
Yeah, so I guess it was just going back to that, working at fine restaurants all the time. And then my sister, who's always been an inspiration for me, she's a couple years younger, but she runs an NGO called Noma Gaia. She has her PhD in epidemiology, and she's just incredibly committed to making the world a better place in whatever capacity she can. So I would see her, you know, make change with water rights in Jordan, or fight on behalf of workers in Peru and Belize, you know, for sugarcane farming conditions and that kind of thing. And so it just felt like we might as well be able to give back in some capacity to organizations that we believed in. And Girasole was our very first wine.
So you did some net proceeds donated.
Yeah,
nice.
With the Tory Burch Foundation. She had been an inspiration for me. I think it was important to see this woman who had a liberal arts background and, you know, went to school in Philly and hadn't really been focused on, you know, her industry all her life, and then totally crushed it. And she was supportive when I had this idea, and it just felt like the natural thing
and
to
do. And
then
the other wines you've done, other charitable
exactly.
donations.
So Scopello, the Frappato, we donate to my sister's NGO, Noma Gaia, that pushes multinational corporations to respect human rights. And then the Caldera, which the label was designed by Claudia Wu from Cherry Bomb.
Right.
She's so talented.
Who does a show here.
Yes, exactly. And so she and I sat down and we said, well, what should we make the focus for Caldera? And we both decided that if there isn't a planet, then no other conversation is relevant. So we might as well focus on that, and we donate to Earth Justice.
Nice. So kudos to you for that.
Well, thank you.
That's a nice thing. All right, let's talk about Ramona. We don't have a ton of time, so let's buzz through everything. So you started Ramona in 2016. We talked about this a little before, but tell my listeners, what was the inspiration? How did Ramona come about?
Yeah, Ramona.
And I think we should crack.
Yes.
Benny, will you crack a can, and you and I could share a glass? You hear that fizzy Ramona can? All right, so what was the inspiration?
Okay, the inspiration, I guess a few things. The main one was just like wondering whatever happened to wine coolers, remembering them.
Why, did you have like a past of just getting buzzed on wine coolers as a teenager or something?
I remember the first time, because I'm not a beer person. I've never really found, like, Natty Light was the drink of Haverford College. So I remember.
Some mainline beer, that is.
I think at some point somebody brought something of some wine cooler, and it was definitely, in my opinion at that time, it was more delicious than Natty Light. And so and then I forgot about wine coolers, and it came up, I think it was like a conversation, Talia Bioki and I were chatting, and we're like, whatever happened to those? And then that sort of thought and nostalgia led to the realization that it, you know, why not just try and make this? By this point, I, you know, had a few vintages of Bellis under my belt and figured, you know, we could get some.
You had your sea legs.
We had our sea legs and figured we could find some good, you know, organic.
So it was only a year ago.
Yeah.
It's been on the market a year plus type thing.
Not even a year, no.
And you're having a heck of a season with it. So what is Ramona? You know, I did a little research, and if I'm right, it's some crazy grape, Zabibbo, or no?
Mm-hmm.
What is a Zabibbo grape?
All right, so I think it, Zabibbo.
Zabibbo.
It is the same as Muscat of Alexandria.
Okay.
Which is harvested dry here. We did a whole bunch of tests initially. We're like, we'll do it local.
Different grapes, wines, areas, and all of that. So you put some thought into what the final blend is.
A lot of thought and a lot of different testing. You know, it started off in the kitchen and you know, like experimenting with different kind of grapefruit and different other flavors.
So when you crack open a can of Ramona, what's in it? Mm. So you have white wine, Zabibbo.
Yep.
keep going.
Yeah, and I guess going forward, we're tweaking that a little bit. It's going to be white wine, and then we're going to add a little bit of a red wine from Sicily as well, so that we'll get our color that way. But then also just natural grapefruit flavor, natural ruby grapefruit, and a little bit of organic cane sugar.
Okay.
And then we carbonate it slightly.
Now, does this can we're drinking have any red wine in it or not yet?
This one does not. So this is from the actual grapefruit.
Okay. All right. So that's Ramona. I'm just curious. There's more canned wines and spritzers in the last year, than before.
Crazy.
Why do you think this segment blew up?
Such a good question. Because when we released Ramona over Labor Day last year, and there were like two or three other canned wines on the market.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden,
you don't know what other people are doing, and then it blows up.
Funny, yeah.
But like we talked about social media and, your presence in the wine market, you've had a great launch. All right, so that's Ramona Wine Spritzer. We'll talk about where it's available. We don't have a ton of time, so we're going to buzz through the rest of the show. I want to subject you to our wine list. It's about five questions. Don't dwell on them. Just answer them. And the first question is, what are you drinking now? Are you tasting things, trying them? Are you and Robert trying stuff?
Yes.
For work, for home? What is it?
My new thing is that I borrow this from Guillaume d'Angerville, which is how he ended up with his Jura estate. But whenever I go to a restaurant.
He makes an Arbois Pelican.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Okay, so what are you drinking now?
I say to the sommelier, I would like you to bring me something. Usually it's white because, or if I'm drinking rosé, then that's another thing. But I say to the sommelier, I'd like something white. And it can't be from Burgundy.
Okay. So you're looking at whites from anywhere.
Yeah. And
is
it
that
has to be
seasonal because it's summer a little, or you just want to get deeper into whites?
Yeah.
Both.
No. I mean, I would say I drink plenty more whites than reds, generally speaking.
Normally. Okay. Would you say Robert drinks more reds than whites?
No. He probably
really?
Also okay. drinks more whites than reds.
All right. Good answer. What is Jordan Salcido's favorite wine and food pairing?
Oof. Yes, champagne, specifically Facsimile from Jérôme Prévost. So it's rosé.
We will post that.
Along with fried zucchini blossoms.
Great answer. Great with any fried food.
Yes, totally.
So, but zucchini blossoms, that's a first. Yeah. You know everyone says Muscadet and oysters, champagne and oysters.
Right.
So it's refreshing. All right. So you work at a restaurant. Your husband owns and runs restaurants. So get out of your comfort zone. Your favorite wine restaurant and our bar outside of those. Mm. Pasquale Jones has been people's answers, before you and Charlie Bird. So we know they're great wine and food places. But if Jordan doesn't go to those places, give me a couple of people that are doing it right. Great wine service, great wine selection, good food to complement.
Yeah.
Give me one or two in New York.
Okay, in New
Without incriminating anything.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and just because I think it's always hard to, take your restaurant and move it. And I feel like if people have not been to EMP at the beach, they are doing an excellent job.
EMP is closing to fix their place up. And they opened a place out in the Hamptons.
Yep.
EMP's Summer Place. That's what you're alluding to?
Yep, I think
lucky to get in.
You can get in.
Okay.
You can even go for a glass of wine.
Okay.
That's a good
summary answer.
It's a good summary answer. Let's see. I mean, Nomad is part of that same family.
Okay,
that's
so
great.
Nomad, good enough.
Yeah.
Jordan's favorite all-time wine. Do you have one that you could peg?
I mean,
or if it's not the one, what's one of the ones?
No, I mean, the wine that I would say is one we spoke about earlier. It's like an obnoxious thing to say now because it's not a wine that I come across with any sort of frequency. But that wine that I got to try when we were dating in our early days was, I'll give a high and a low. So
go ahead.
Favorite high wine would be that 1980 Jaillet Brûlé.
Okay.
And that was a magical wine. Favorite low wine, $10 or less. Oh, got it. Sangiovese, Fuori Strada, Sangiovese and Tetra Pak.
Wait, what's Fuori Strada? The maker?
Off-road, yeah.
Oh, off-road?
Yeah, so it's...
Spell that.
Fuori Strada.
Okay.
And I would say that wine got me thinking outside the box and
they could do it right for the price.
Yeah.
And my next question, and this just isn't for you, I ask everybody, and you should know, and I'm going to qualify it. I ask people the best wine around $15-$20. Ben here is going to a dinner. His friends are thoughtfully making a nice meal. He wants to bring 2-3 bottles of wine. He's not going to spend more than $15-$20. So I'll answer it first, then you answer it second.
Okay.
Because the Bellis wines are basically priced $20 to $30 or less,
mm-hmm.
closer to the 20, mid-20s. So any of the Bellis wines would make sense. But what else can you think of red and white?
Yeah, okay. Just one red, one white?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So Mick Craven of Craven Wines, he's doing very cool work in South Africa
okay.
with old vines. He has a claret that's great. His Chenin is spectacular.
C-R-A-V-E-N, you said?
C-R-A-V-E-N, yeah.
Mick or Nick?
Mick. Like
Mick Craven.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mick Craven. So Craven Wines, those are delicious.
Great, great. Recommend.
And I would say I'm going to do two because the other one that's sort of in that same camp is the Jauma wines, J-A-U-M-A.
From?
From McLaren Vale in Australia. Yeah.
Okay.
And those are really fun, delicious, thoughtful.
And they're priced $15-$20?
Yeah, I think they're like $20-$21.
All right, so we'll post those and I'll also post the Bellis lineup, which certainly
that's
fits,
so sweet.
You know, that
Thank
bill.
You.
That bill and all.
And then red, I didn't give you a red. Punta Crena, I would say, is amazing.
P-U-N-T-A?
Yeah.
C-R-E-N-A. From?
From Liguria.
Okay.
It's a Kermit
Liguria,
Lynch wine.
Italy.
Yeah.
Okay. Kermit Lynch wine.
Yep.
All right, Jordan, we're going to wrap up. Every week we taste a different wine on air. I promise you for our weekly wine sip, we taste the Bellis La Vienne Rose, a still rosé. This is the still, right?
This is the still.
Which we're not going to have anymore. They'll
no,
be sparkling.
Yeah, so
a still rosé with an interesting grape blend from Mendocino. Yeah. There's all kinds of cockamamie grapes
totally,
in here, right?
Totally.
Tell me some of the grapes.
Okay, Cunoise, Old Vine Cunoise, Alicante
Which,
Boucher.
C-O-U-N-O-I-S-E.
Exactly.
Did I get, you know, you don't
exactly,
even know how to spell
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
What else?
Syrah, Petite Syrah.
Okay.
Alicante Boucher, Mourvedre.
So it's a terrific blend of interesting California wines. Are all those from Eagle Point or are they
yes,
from all?
Yes, they're
okay.
all from Eagle
so
Point.
So one vineyard in Mendocino is growing all those crazy mm-hmm. grapes that nobody ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
The wine retails for $20 and up, right?
Exactly.
And it's available. Available at better wine shops.
Yeah.
Your crappy wine shop's not going to carry
exactly.
it and all that.
Exactly.
All right, so let's take a quick evaluation. It's got a very nice coppery pink deep, right?
Yeah. No, and we're in this like lovely lighting in here. But
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dark.
Yeah.
The nose, quickly, what do you get?
The nose. Mm-hmm, like rhubarb and like strawberries.
Okay.
And like hibiscus flowers.
Interesting. The mouthfeel is medium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a thin wine. It's
mm-hmm.
you know, you wouldn't expect a rosé to be unctuous, but it's got a nice mouthfeel. Tell me what you get on the palate. Does the nose carry over?
For me, it does. When we were making this wine, we wanted it to be a rosé that didn't just belong in summer, that it could...
I agree with that.
It could carry through to like a roast chicken.
Like a Bandol Tempia.
Yeah,
you could drink it any time.
Exactly.
Right. So give me some palate descriptors.
Palate descriptors, yeah. Okay, so I would say for me, there's definitely like ripe cherry here, and there's some strawberry rhubarb again.
Some red fruits.
Red
for sure.
fruits, like even some red flowers and some white flowers.
What would you pair?
What would I pair? I mean, I love having this wine with roast chicken.
Roast chicken
yeah,
is great.
I know that's a boring answer.
No. We all eat a lot of chicken.
We all eat a lot of chicken.
What else? Give me
like
an
cheese plate. Like sometimes just cheese
good
and
with
crackers.
A cheese plate. Okay, I like that.
What else? Peanut butter and jelly, I feel like.
Okay, I like that.
That.
Now, Ramona is a white wine with grapefruit. That's just a fun wine to drink. But if you had to pair Ramona with food...
Yes.
Barbecue,
yeah,
I mean, at
sure.
the beach, sandwiches, anything, right?
Lobster rolls. Pork buns, it's good with pork buns.
There you
or
go.
Fried chicken sandwiches. Yeah. It's also good if you want to mix it. Sometimes, like Robert, for example, pours it into a glass with a shot of
chocolate
tequila.
Milk? Oh.
A shot of tequila.
The Ramona in tequila?
The Ramona in tequila, yeah.
I didn't know he was that wild.
The
I
Ramona
thought he was more reserved.
No, not at all. He's from New Jersey.
Oh, okay. That explains everything. So am I. All right. So that is the Bellis La Vienne Rosé, which Next year, probably look for a sparkling rosé made by Michael Cruz, which should be a home run.
Yeah.
And the Ramona sparkling wine in the can. All right, Jordan, we're going to wrap everything up. If you have a question, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. We'll post Jordan's wine list answers and our weekly wine sip choices on the site, all the Bellis wines, the Ramon, and all that stuff. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, Twitter at BenRuby, and check out our new, beautiful, gorgeous website, www.thegrapenation.com. You'll see a beautiful picture of Jordan. You'll see all her choices and any background. Jordan, where can we find you on social media? Let's talk you personal first. Jordan, at Jordan Salcido.
At Jordan Salcido.
JordanSalcito.
Exactly.
Instagram, Twitter.
Yep.
Facebook.
Yep.
Okay. And let's talk about brands. Ramona is at Drink Ramona.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff.
Exactly.
And Bellis Wines.
Is at Bellis Wines.
B-E-L-L-U-S Wines with an S, right?
Exactly.
Twitter, Instagram. Now, if I wanted to learn more and go on the websites, it would be drinkramona.com.
Drinkramona.com. If you go on in the next 2 to 3 days, we're upgrading it, so we're making it more beautiful.
Okay.
So you might get a little page that directs you to our Instagram. But otherwise,
but
be
go
patient.
Back. Go back. And on Bellis.
BellisWines.com.
And, you know, I've been on the sites. You could get descriptions of all the wines, what's available. You can buy it and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And are you at Momofuku from time to time?
Yes,
okay.
I am.
So if you're at Momofuku, are you at what, Co or different ones?
More at Co,
okay.
Yeah.
Look and ask for Jordan. Yep. She'll turn you on to some good wines.
Sometimes Sambar. Sambar has a really fun program. They've been putting a lot of focus on the list. And teams there are all amazing.
It's obvious because you're there. There's a very astute attention towards wine. So, you know, if you're at any of those, see if Jordan's around. All right. I want to thank our guest, Jordan Salcido from Bellis, Ramona, and Momofuku. I want to thank our engineer tonight, sitting in, David Tatasciore, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.